Lowe's knows you take pride in every project. So take on what's next today with a free select Craftsman hedge trimmer or leaf blower when you buy a 20-volt push mower. That's a $119 value on reliable, high-performance Craftsman tools you trust. For the power to do it all, build, repair, restore, maintain, go with Craftsman. Available at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 5/21. While supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hi guys, welcome back to Textory, the podcast where we're reading historical texts and reacting to them. Today we will be reading a text that single-handedly changed the history of cinema forever. I can't help but think, like, what would cinema, what would Hollywood be like if it weren't for that one single document? You may already know what I'm talking about, but let's move back in time to the 1920s. In 1920s, the public opinion of Hollywood was not great. The Fatty Arbuckle scandal happened, in which one of the most popular actors in silent cinema, Fatty Arbuckle, was accused of raping and killing a girl. This went on for several years. There were three different trials, and he eventually was cleared. It is a messy case. There was a lot of bribery. There was a lot of trying to get witnesses to say what you want them to say. There was not much evidence. It was a whole mess. Whether or not he was actually guilty, to be fair, looking at it from a time perspective, it does seem like it was just people trying to destroy him. And fat phobia was definitely also a factor because he was a fat actor. And a lot of the reasoning was that he was so fat that he murdered the girl with his weight, which was absolutely not backed up by any sort of evidence that they had. But also, I need to like keep space for victims. And again, it's only her friend that accused him of this. It's not the actual victim, but we'll never know. So I'm not saying he didn't do it. We'll never know. But this scandal, it shocked the general public. Everyone was like, Hollywood is so depraved. And they weren't wrong, because even if that case didn't happen, the whole situation took place at a very excessive party in a hotel where they rented out a party room. And there was even photos that were like police evidence showing a completely wrecked space. So there was a lot of alcohol involved. There was a lot of wild partying involved. So they weren't necessarily wrong, because Hollywood is even now known for their maybe not traditional lifestyles, I would say. But basically, because the public opinion of Hollywood was so bad, an association was found, which was called Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America. It was found in, I think, 1922, and it was basically focused on a public relations campaign that was supposed to show that Hollywood is respectable as an industry. And the first president of that association was Will H. Hayes. Now, you may be familiar with that name if you're interested in the history of cinema. Will Hayes was a Republican. I'm not sure if that tells you anything about him, but it probably does signify that he had some conservative views. At the time, when you produce a film and the film got censored, you basically had to pay the censor for each foot of the footage that was removed. And they were trying to make Hollywood as lucrative as possible. So Hayes was like, okay, let's write down some tips for the studios on how to film and what things to avoid, so then they don't have to remove too many things. But of course, since these were more like guidelines, why does it sound like the quote from Pirates of the Caribbean? These were just guidelines, so people did not really care and they did not feel obliged to follow them. People just didn't really find them to be that binding. But by the end of the decade, the industry was under a lot of pressure from Catholic activists and the Catholic Church. And eventually, Hayes Code, as it was commonly referred to, was implemented in 1930. However, when it comes to actual movies, it wasn't really in use until 1934. That's when the code was reinforced and strengthened. So any movies from before 1934 are historically referred to as pre-code movies. And let me just say, these are so incredible because, you know, Hays Code was in use for several decades and pre-code cinema was kind of a short period in cinema history. So when we think classic Hollywood, we usually think of those Hays Code complying, very posh, very polished and very modest films. But when you watch pre-code movies, so these are also old classic Hollywood movies, there is just so many innuendos, there is so much nudity, there is all this content that is quite shocking. I wouldn't say by modern standards, but by modern understanding of what classic Hollywood was like, it just really takes you out of this impression that it was all prim and proper. Anyway, so those good old days of pre-code cinema were gone when the code was reinforced in 1934. And today we are going to read some of the code guidelines regarding what could and what couldn't be portrayed in movies and what was sort of the reasoning, because they thought they're doing a good thing, right? So first of all, they were worried that if you show evil on screen and you present it in a good light, it's going to demoralize American citizens and they're just going to go and do the same thing that they saw on screen, which is a pretty demeaning way of seeing your audience, because people have brains and they can hopefully differentiate between good and bad. They don't need to be led by the hand. But at the same time, cinema at the time was definitely influential because it was a new medium. Everything that was shown on screen was shown for like almost the first time. What I mean is there were a lot of shots, themes, and techniques that were just being invented. So it probably was much more impressionable crowd. But at the same time, it was definitely an overkill. So they start off by saying, motion pictures are very important as art. Though a new art, possibly a combination art, it has the same object as the other arts, the presentation of human thoughts, emotions, and experiences in terms of an appeal to the soul through the senses. Here, as in entertainment, art enters intimately into the lives of human beings. Art can be morally good, lifting men to higher levels. This has been done through good music, great painting, authentic fiction, poetry, drama. Art can be morally evil in its effects. This is the case clearly enough with unclean art, indecent books, suggestive drama. The effect on the lives of men and women is obvious. So they start off on this very like intellectual note about film being art, and they mention that it is a new art, but that it still has the ability to change people's lives, which I agree with. A good movie can change your life, but can it be morally evil in its effects? I guess if you're talking about like propaganda pieces, they definitely can affect people's lives for worse, but they say it's the case with unclean art. No picture should lower the moral standards of those who see it. This is done, A, when evil is made to appear attractive and good is made to appear unattractive, and B, when the sympathy of the audience is thrown on the side of crime, wrongdoing, evil, sin. The same thing is true of a film that would throw sympathy against goodness, honor, innocence, purity, honesty. So sadly, because of a paragraph like this, post-code films, or just the films that adhered to the code, did not feature a morally dubious character that was getting away with their crimes. Everyone had to be punished because otherwise you were glorifying wrongdoing and crime. I have to say, when I actually read the document, there were a lot of things that I think we could still agree on and that I think could even be applied to modern movies. Here is a note on sexual assault basically being showed in pictures. Seduction and rape are difficult subjects and bad material from the viewpoint of the general audience in the theater. They should never be introduced as subject matter unless absolutely essential to the plot. They should never be treated as comedy. Which I completely agree with, and I think it's still... it is an unwritten rule, because if anyone made a movie where a sexual assault scene would be comical, it would probably just either not get distributed or get a lot of hate, and rightly so. Where essential to the plot, they must not be more than suggested. Even the struggles preceding rape should not be shown. Again, something I think a lot of modern movies could use, because... a lot of the sexual assault scenes in movies, I wouldn't say are necessary for the plot, or they don't need to be that graphic. There are ways to show it in a way where you get what is happening and you are emotionally invested and affected, but without traumatizing you. And I think this rule could still be in place. Scenes of passion are sometimes necessary for the plot. I guess they're referring to basically sex scenes. However, they should appear only where necessary and not as an added stimulus to the emotions of the audience. When not essential to the plot, they should not occur. Again, something like, I must admit, I am not a fan of those scenes in modern movies because they're just boring. They're boring to watch and they often do not bring anything to the plot. Like, just think about those two episodes in Bridgerton season one where it was just them going around different places and doing the deed. Like, that's just not interesting to watch for me because it doesn't push the plot further. It might be conservative of me to say, but I wouldn't mind a reduced number of scenes like that in movies because it's not pushing the plot forward. But then they go a little too far because they say they must not be explicit in action nor vivid in method. For example, by handling of the body, by lustful and prolonged kissing, by evidently lustful embraces, by positions which strongly arouse passions. So they're basically saying don't touch. Just don't touch. In general, where essential to the plot, scenes of passion should not be presented in such a way as to arouse or excite the passions of the ordinary spectator. So they can't be too sexy, that's what they're saying, because then the viewer will leave the cinema and would want to do the same thing. Then, of course, there is a mention of swear words. It's not like there were a lot of swear words to begin with in cinema, but they went a little further. Obscenity, in fact, that is, in spoken word, gesture, episode, plot, is against divine and human law, and hence altogether outside the range of subject or treatment. Obscenity should not be suggested by gesture, manner, etc. An obscene reference, even if it is expected to be understandable to only the more sophisticated part of the audience, should not be introduced. Obscene language is treated as all obscenity. So not just the language, but like the gestures, I'm assuming innuendos, which were very common in the pre-code movies, all that is unacceptable. Then I mentioned there was frequent nudity. I wouldn't say like full nudity, but there was some nudity in pre-code movies, especially when it came to like see-through garments, very deep plunging necklines on women, etc., and very scantily clad dancers and side characters. So here is what they said about nudity. The effect of nudity or semi-nudity upon the normal man or woman, and much more upon the young person, has been honestly recognized by all lawmakers and moralists. Hence, the fact that the nude or semi-nude body may be beautiful does not make its use in the films moral. For in addition to its beauty, the effects of the nude or semi-nude on the normal individual must be taken into consideration. Nudity or semi-nudity, used simply to put a punch into a picture, comes under the head of immoral actions as treated above. It is immoral in its effect upon the average audience. Nudity or semi-nudity is sometimes apparently necessary for the plot. Nudity is never permitted. Semi-nudity may be permitted under conditions. The conditions being like literally never happened. Like they even had problems with someone's shoulder showing sometimes. But I think what made it a little more tricky was the fact that they did not really have different age limits on movies yet. So basically everyone from the age of like 2 to 99 could watch the same movie. Thus, I'm assuming why basically every movie had to be to a certain degree family friendly, because they just did not differentiate between them yet. And then one of those rules that I'm saying still makes sense in modern day movie making: the more intimate parts of the human body are the male and female organs and the breasts of a woman. They should never be uncovered. They should not be covered with transparent or translucent material. I guess they added this point because it happened a lot in pre-code. They should not be clearly and unmistakably outlined by the garment. The less intimate parts of the body, the legs, arms, shoulders, and back, are less certain of causing reactions of the part of the audience. Hence, exposure necessary for the plot or action is permitted. Exposure for the sake of exposure or the punch is wrong. Scenes of undressing should be avoided. And I think it's interesting because, again, it's things that appeared a lot in pre-code cinema. Those like very unsuggestive but very casual scenes of someone undressing or changing. And it truly did not happen much after the code was implemented. And I said it could still apply to modern movies in a way because, A, we still don't show genitals on camera because that's the complicated line between movies and erotica. But also, I feel like a lot of women that are exposed in the movies are just this like male fantasy, and it's absolutely not necessary. And a lot of actresses have come out about not feeling comfortable with it and not feeling like it was necessary for their characters to do so. I think a rule like that, where you had to really, really justify wanting to expose an actress in the movie, would also be beneficial to the actresses, because not every actress dreams of having a scene like that, and they should be allowed to refuse and not be afraid that they're not going to get the part. That's my reasoning. Then they are shitting on dancing, which, again, a lot of those rules make sense when you watch pre-code movies, because it's something that pre-code loved was all of the dancing scenes and dance shows and dancers as characters, etc. So they wrote about dancing. Dancing in general is recognized as an art and a beautiful form of expressing human emotion. Obscene dances are those which suggest or represent sexual actions, whether performed solo or with two or more, which are designed to excite an audience, to arouse passions, or to cause physical excitement. I'm kind of thinking of this one scene in Metropolis, the silent movie, where there is a scene of the female character dancing for the male gaze and for the male audience, and they get super excited. But when you think about it, like, the dance is not really sexy at all by modern standards. It's a German film, though, so I don't think it applies, but I'm guessing they were referring to scenes like that. Hence, dances of the type known as cooch, no idea what that was, but I love the name, or can-can, since they violate decency in these two ways, are wrong. So basically, can-can is considered to either represent sexual actions, which I don't think it is, or are designed to excite the audience. So can-can, who would have thought? Dances with movements of the breasts, excessive body movement while the feet remain stationary. What is that even supposed to mean? Like, you can't move your body while your feet are on the ground? The so-called belly dances. Oh, okay, that makes sense that I didn't love belly dances, because belly dancing is really hot, so it makes sense. These dances are immoral, obscene, and hence altogether wrong. I find it interesting that they considered belly dancing to be like an erotic dance, because it's a very white way to see it. It's a dance that has been definitely like a cultural dance for many cultures, and it's not inherently sensual. It's just like an expression of self or the culture, but it is a very white way to see it, because I imagine in 1920s Hollywood, it was something completely new, and it was considered shockingly sensual by their standards. Then something which I'm a little torn on, because I can't decide whether I approve of it or not. But basically, there is a whole paragraph on portraying religion. So originally, I thought it's just going to be about you can't mock Catholic priests on screen. But they actually do say that it should apply to all religions, which I think is quite progressive. I don't know if they actually meant all religions or just all religions that we care about. So it would be like different flavors of Christianity. I don't know. But the way they phrased it, it does sound like they respected all religions. I don't know. Like, you tell me. No film or episode in a film should be allowed to throw ridicule on any religious faith honestly maintained. Ministers of religion in their characters or ministers should not be used in comedy as villains or as unpleasant persons, which it probably applied mostly to Catholic or Christian ministers. But I'm just thinking, like, what if someone was mocking, let's say, a Buddhist monk in a movie in the 1930s? Would they care? Or would they just be like, it's not even a real religion? The reason for this is not that there are not such ministers of religion. We love self-aware queens, so they're like, we know that there are bad ministers or funny ministers, but we shouldn't be showing that on screen. So they're saying the reason for this is not that there are not such ministers of religion, but because the attitude toward them tends to be an attitude toward religion in general. Religion is lowered in the minds of the audience because it lowers their respect for the ministers. So they're worried that if you're going to mock religion, people are going to stop being religious, I guess. And then something really interesting, which is, again, making me think that they were a little more diverse than they make it out to be, because they said ceremonies of any definite religion should be supervised by someone thoroughly conversant with that religion. So you're not supposed to make up, let's say, a Muslim wedding on screen. I hope that's what they meant. They don't specify that it's supposed to be Christian, so I'm thinking maybe they meant Judaism, Buddhism, all these religions that were also practiced in the US at the time. Then they have several random rules. So sex perversion or any inference to it is forbidden. Whatever they meant by it, I guess it was a very loose rule and could be applied depending on how strict the censor was. White slavery shall not be treated, but it only says white slavery, so other slaveries are completely fine. And then they also say miscegenation, sex relationship between the white and black races is forbidden. And this is one of the aspects of Hays Code that I guess it probably was not portrayed much either way, even without the code, but I can't keep thinking, like, what would cinema history look like if that paragraph was not there? Because we probably missed out on so many beautiful stories because of that one paragraph. And I feel like even though Hays Code is long, long gone and it's not in use anymore, the direct consequences can still be felt, because look how long it took us to make movies where people of color would be main characters or main love interests without that being the sole theme of the movie. Literally the last 10, 15 years, it's only been happening. So this is definitely one of the parts of Hays Code that were very damaging to the film industry as a whole. And then they also have other rules. Scenes of actual childbirth, in fact or in silhouette, are never to be presented. I'm genuinely not sure why, since they were so obsessed with having children, but I'm assuming it was too close to female genitals to show, because, you know, if someone's giving birth, then we know where the child is coming from, and that was a little too spicy for their taste. But then they also say children's sex organs are never to be exposed. And I'm like, why did they have to implement this rule? Like, was that not a thing before? Did they actually show that on screen? Because it's actually terrifying to think about. I did mention obscenity, as in like swear words, gestures, but they do mention profanity as well. And they list all the words that you're not supposed to use. So it's like, pointed profanity, this includes the words God, Lord, Jesus, Christ, unless used reverently, hell, son of a bitch, damn, God, or every other profane or vulgar expression, however used, is forbidden. This is a little unclear to me because it says unless used reverently, and then it says hell. It doesn't actually say son of a bitch. It says SOB. Damn God. Like, I wonder if that was actually allowed, because I know there is some swearing in old movies, but I think it was still a big, big, big issue, as we know with the Gone with the Wind story of them trying really hard to convince the censor board to allow Clark Gable to say, I don't give a damn. So I do assume that all these words are forbidden as well. Then there is a specification about subjects that must be treated within limits. Actual hangings or electrocutions as legal punishments for a crime. Third-degree methods, so basically torture. Brutality and possible gruesomeness. Branding of people and animals, that is very specific. Apparent cruelty to children or animals. The sale of women or a woman selling her virtue. Surgical operations. So these are not completely forbidden. These are just subjects that will probably get you in trouble, and you better have a good reason to include them. A careful distinction can be made between films intended for general distribution and films intended for use in theaters restricted to a limited audience. So there were theaters that were more catering towards a particular demographic. Themes and plots quite appropriate for the latter would be altogether out of place and dangerous in the former. Some other subjects that were delicate was national feelings. The just rights, history, and feelings of any nation are entitled to most careful consideration and respectful treatment. Then movie titles. As the title of a picture is the brand on that particular type of goods, it must conform to the ethical practices of all such honest business. So it was important to keep the title family-friendly as well. And then repellent subjects, so the subjects that we've already discussed. Such subjects are occasionally necessary for the plot. Their treatment must never offend good taste nor injure the sensibilities of an audience. Anyway, that's all that I had from the Hays Code, but I do have some bonuses. So first of all, I found a leaflet from SNA Film Company, which was based in Chicago, and they were buying scripts. And they wrote in the leaflet why your script was returned or just not taken into account. So it was like either weak plot or not our style of story. Idea has been done before, and you would get one of the reasons checked. So then you know what's wrong with your script, which is a very nice feedback, I think. But one of the reasons would be robbery, kidnapping, murder, suicide, harrowing deathbed, and all scenes of an unpleasant nature should be eliminated. So if your script featured any of those, it would be automatically returned or just not accepted. If you were wondering how the code was implemented, like how strict they were, I have a letter about the script for Wuthering Heights. The letter is from 1936. It's to Mr. Walter Wanger. And this is what they had to say about the script. Dear Mr. Wanger, we have received and read your script, Wuthering Heights, and are happy to report that the story seems to meet the basic requirements of the production code. There are, however, a few minor details to which we suggest you give further consideration in shooting, as follows. Throughout the script, there are a number of uses of the expression hell. While in our estimation they do not constitute a code violation, as used in this script, nevertheless, it is barely possible that some censor boards may want to delete some of them. It would be our recommendation that, wherever possible, you replace this word with something else in order to protect yourself against such mutilation. Page 34. Care will be needed with this scene of Heathcliff fighting off the dog. It is possible that censor boards might delete any scenes of him hitting the animal with a stone. This goes under the paragraph of not showing animal cruelty that we just read about. Page 48. It is possible that political censor boards may delete this action of Heathcliff slapping Kathy. We suggest you protect yourself on it. So again, this goes under violence against women, I guess. Page 58. The word hell appears here, also on pages 67, 74, 76, 94, 99, and 115. As suggested above, we recommend dropping these wherever possible. So they basically said, hell is not inherently against the code, but if you use it multiple times, it will bring the attention of the censor board. So please be careful. And then to finish it off, I have a clipping from an article from the Sunday Star, April 13th, 1930. So it was as the code was beginning to be implemented, even though they actually did not pay much attention to it until 4 years later. But they are definitely critical of Hays. And I think that was the general feeling at the time. Like, the production companies were probably like, okay, whatever, we just need to follow the rules and we'll be fine. But the general public was not very happy with it. His Serene Eminence, Will H. Hays, Tsar of all the cinemas, has been particularly vocal of late. Just the way they introduce him, you can tell someone had a massive beef with him. He has been sounding notes of optimism and issuing threats for release Monday. His emergence is due to two causes. One of them is the desire to cooperate in the restoration of prosperity, and the other is the determination to silence all the uproar about screen censorship, which is becoming unduly vociferous. Concerning prosperity, Tsar Hays wishes it to be known that the film industry is doing its bit. In a speech over the radio, he said, "The motion picture carries to every American home and to millions of potential purchasers abroad the visual vivid perception of American manufactured products. Our standards of living are steadily on the upward trend. We appreciate more the good things of life. We want more, we work for more, we buy more, and to all this increasing spiral of demand, motion pictures contribute more every day." So his reasoning is that people watch American movies and the people abroad, they imagine that this is what America looks like. The author of the article goes on to say, "However, be it said that Tsar Hays has done his utmost to prevent the propagation of false doctrines on the screen by issuing a code of morals to which all the movie magnates must subscribe. A more severe code was outlined by Louis B. Mayer some years ago and then instantly forgotten. In fact, among the first to forget it was Mr. Mayer himself. As he proved in his own subsequent productions, I was not aware of Louis B. Mayer dropping a code before Hays and then ignoring it completely in his own movies. I need to read more into that. The Hays code, which also may be instantly forgotten, is a model of circumspection. For instance, it provides that sympathy shall not be created for the violation of the law, and then goes on to say the use of liquor in American life shall be restricted to the actual requirements of characterization or plot. Thus, if leading characters, both male and female, in a photoplay are inveterate drinkers, and a plot deals with bootlegging and hijackery, then the use of liquor in American life is permissible. It is absolutely forbidden, however, if the characters in the photoplay happen to be teetotalers, as they so often are." I'm actually not sure what the author of the article means here. He's saying that if you interpret the Hays Code in a way where you have to only portray alcohol on screen where it's vital for the plot, then that means that it's only going to be showing stories of crime. Whereas if it was actually just a casual, let's say, party where non-drinkers are, it's not permissible. And I'm not sure if that was the case. I don't think they were that strict on it. And I think they probably improved the rules since then. But it definitely shows how many questions people had regarding the code. And the censor boards themselves were probably a little lost as to what they should pay attention to. Similarly, the Tsar issues the ukase that scenes of passion shall not be introduced when not essential to the plot. "With all due reverence to Tsar Hays, I beg him to cite one of the standard movie plots in which scenes of passion are not essential. Remove all passion from plots, and where would the motion picture industry make the money with which to pay the salary of the Tsar?" Near the end of his code, Tsar Hays gives expression to an admirable thought. Listing certain subjects, he says that they must be treated within the limits of good taste. If only he had reduced his whole code to this one commandment: abide within the limits of good taste. He could have stopped there with fine effect. That he didn't is due to the realistic shrewdness which he gained during his political career. He knew enough not to demand the impossible. Were good taste prevalent in the motion picture industry, there would be no more need for troublesome censors or for insulting critics, and there would be certainly no more need for Will H. Hayes. That's the end of the article. Again, the public reaction to it was definitely mixed, and I'm assuming moviegoers, the really passionate ones, were not happy with it because they were already used to seeing all those things on screen, and then all of that was suddenly taken away from them. Even though they do mention things that definitely should not appear on screen, I do think that majority of the movies at the time was already adhering to those rules, even though they were not implemented, because they knew more or less what's gonna fly. I can't help but think what movie history would be like if Hays Code did not exist. I think we have a sample of that when we watch foreign movies from like the 40s, 50s, 60s, because it's definitely different. And there are scenes included in those movies that would not fly in Hollywood. But at the same time, it was still heavily influencing the foreign movies because everyone making foreign movies was dreaming of showing them in Hollywood, obviously. So I think Hays took a lot of things from us, and it's a little sad. But it also made the movie industry learn how to show things rather than tell things, and how to be delicate about treating certain subjects, and how to be visual about it instead of like straight up going for it, which I think is a good thing. But that's just like a side effect of an actually very damaging document that ruined the cinema a little bit. A little bit, because, you know, there were still a lot of great movies in the classic Hollywood period that are definitely for the history books. But what would they be like if the Hays Code would not be implemented? That's what I keep thinking, and I just find it really interesting. Anyway, let me know what you think about the whole code situation, and if you have watched any pre-code movies that you like, do let me know, because I'm looking for recommendations. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this one. Don't forget to check out my Patreon at patreon.com/textory, and I'll hear you in another episode. Bye!